Yo, everybody, welcome to a brand new Techish. It is one half of your dynamic hosting duo, Abadesi Osunzade of Hustle Crew, joined with
Michael Behain, CEO of Pocket Jobs. Let's go.
Pocket Jobs. Let's talk about the US government taking USA. On Apple. Boom, boom, hey. Boom. So if you haven't been following the news, it was around mid-March where the U.S. filed a landmark lawsuit against Apple, accusing this tech giant of monopolizing the smartphone market and crushing competition. Apparently, the case is basically centering on the fact that Apple is using a series of shape-shifting rules and restricting access to hardware and software so it can boost its own profits while raising costs to customers and stifling innovation. This isn't the first time that Apple's been under heat for these things, but this is the first time the U.S. government is going against one of its own. Why now, Michael? And what is going to happen?
I don't know what's going to happen, because I think the kind of department that deals with, you know, anti-competitiveness has lost a few lawsuits. I think against Amazon they lost, so they don't tend to win. But does the case have any merit? I think it does to a certain extent. I think Apple, especially in the way that it treats developers, is very mafia-like. You've got to pay us 30% of whatever you make, no matter what. Even, for example, when Amazon wants to sell you like a Kindle, you know, you can't buy it within the app because they don't want to pay that 30%. So then you've got to go into Amazon.com. But then Apple now prevents Amazon from even mentioning that you can buy it on Amazon.com. So they used to say, can't buy it here. You can go there to buy it. Now they don't even mention it because Apple will take down their app. So to me, that is mafia-like. Yo, like, you can't even tell people about the existence of a different way to buy.
That's crazy.
We have to get our 30%. To me, that's wild. Obviously, for example, even Spotify dislikes them because, you know, oftentimes Apple will present their music app as default or their music app as the kind of way to go, for example. So there definitely is an issue there. And then some people even claim that the kind of prevalence of that whole blue bubble, green text thing, that itself is a form of like anti-competitiveness.
Because it's obviously, like, you on Android? Oh.
Yeah. So in the UK and the rest of the world, it's not that much of a big deal because we all of us have WhatsApp, which is that universal kind of messaging app. But in America, where iPhone is very dominant, where iPhone is very dominant and Android is less so, and WhatsApp isn't prevalent, that is a real big deal. People are like, yo, you know, if you're on Android, you know, we don't want you in a group chat, basically. To me, that is a bit of a gray area. To me, that is like, listen, Apple built their products. I don't think they're under any obligation to allow Android phones to work in the exact same way as their phones work. I mean, that to me isn't the biggest deal. That to me is a natural moat that happens when you've got your phone that works in that way.
Yeah.
But I think it goes to the heart of a bigger issue, which is that apart from now the Vision Pro, Apple hasn't really innovated in the last, you know, post-Steve Jobs era. It's been very much iterating on what they've got, milking what they've got, charging you now for chargers. Charging you now for replacing this. You buy the phone now, you don't get
a replacement AirPod is £79.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? AirPod revenue is insane. AirPod revenue combined is larger than, like, you know, Spotify, eBay, PayPal. A lot of these companies combined, AirPods alone are. And how much of that revenue is you've lost one AirPod and you need to go buy a whole new set? How much of that revenue? How many pairs of AirPod have you had? I've had like 10. I'm embarrassed to say that.
Wow.
And a lot of that is because I've just lost them. Oh, listen, you're not better than me. Don't play this. Don't try and show me up like that. I've only had two. You are a terrible human being.
Environmental footprint.
Terrible. But yeah, listen.
And they own Beats as well, right? So they basically cornered the friggin' portable headphone market. And then those AirPod Maxes I see people rocking, those are like £600. It's like, I don't know, $800. Nah, man. Nah. Do you know what? I think what's happening is the government is trying to, you know, correct a market failure, which is, you know, the tax collection. Because these tech companies have, like, finessed their way out of paying, like, an appropriate amount of corporation tax, given the actual revenues that they are making, right, from U.S. customers. And I think what, you know, in the absence of a more efficient tax policy, you have governments trying to find another way to get their dues. And maybe anti-competition is it. But, yeah, I'll be interested to watch the case. I think there'll be a lot of competitors who are happy if the U.S. government wins. Yeah. But I don't think it's going to change the way Apple does business for a long while, because the reality is any hardware maker in the same position as them, to your point, would also be using whatever they have in their power to stifle competition and retain the share price and retain profits.
But how much of
that's
this
capitalism.
Was Apple, but Apple was designed to be like a closed ecosystem. So you get the laptop, it works perfectly with your AirPods, it works perfectly with your phone. Everything is completely synced. Is the government now saying that actually you shouldn't make it that hard for an Android user to come on and, you know, sync their stuff with you, basically, if that makes sense? Or why can't I use my Android with an Apple Watch? Why can't I, like, why is there not an Apple Watch app on my Android phone that I can use that can allow me to keep my Android, you know? And what, you know, do you get what I'm saying? Is
they basically
argue that it's not necessarily innovation, it's actually just like you make it harder for people to switch. It's not as if you're making your product so great that I have to work with you. It's like, no. It's just very difficult once I'm outside that garden wall. I can't use your product as well. So that is an element of, like, you know, anti-competitiveness that's not based on just pure innovation. It's based on we're going to be assholes and make it hard for you to not be part of our life, basically, right? So
that is a
difficult question, because that goes to the heart of what Apple is. Apple has always been that way. The only time they weren't that way was when they had the iPod. And actually, Steve Jobs did not want to make iTunes work with Windows. He only wanted you to use
I love
iTunes.
Steve Jobs' energy, man.
Yeah, he only was like, you can only use initially he was like, you can only use iTunes if you've got an iPhone, I mean an iPhone, an Apple device. And people were like, well, that makes no sense, because you're limiting our market. We have to be able to, you know, sell new singles to people who are on Windows. And he said that when they asked him, what's it like, you know, building for Windows? And he's like, yeah, we're offering Windows users ice cold drink in hell, basically, saying that our software is so beautiful that, like, you know, us being on there is like, yo, it's like a cool drink of ice cold water where you're using, you know, terrible software, basically. But let's see what happens. I don't think it's gonna go far.
But we'll
do you want to talk about this? You want to talk about this Florida banning social media for under 14s?
Yeah. Before we move on to that, I was just gonna say, you talking about iTunes not being available on Microsoft products just brought my memories all the way back to like early internet. Windows Media Player on Windows 98. Hell yes. Shaun the Sheep. Come on. Where are my millennials at? Because when you got Windows 98, it came with Encarta built in. It also came in with like Windows Media Player. But then it had weird songs. Like, I remember I'd never heard the Talking Heads before because my parents weren't white and I was just like not listening to that stuff. And then that was one of the songs that was like preloaded on Windows Media Player. But I remember I used to, when I couldn't get on the internet, I would just like watch the visualizations or just like watch Shaun the Sheep and play random songs. But shout out Windows Media Player on Windows 98, because that was bomb. That was fire for me.
Do you know what? The boredom that existed historically and how we fulfilled the boredom. I remember going on my dad's computer and like playing the games. Like, do you remember
Minesweeper?
What do you know about Minesweeper? Minesweeper. You go on there and you just be there blowing things up. I was like, oh my, that used to keep me entertained.
I used to be like, Dad, please,
can I use your computer so I could go on Minesweeper? Like, when I compare that now to what
now
my nieces
TikTok,
and nephew
bro.
Do,
what,
bro, yeah, it's day
on
and
demand
night,
Netflix, on demand Disney. You would have been on like hour three of Minesweeper by then. Dude, I used to just open up Microsoft Paint and just be drawing pixel by pixel. I'd be like, yo,
Microsoft
I'm
Paint
out
was
here
it.
Vibing. Oh man,
Microsoft
Windows 98.
Paint.
Peak.
But you know what? So now we can segue into this story, because basically this story is about Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, failed presidential candidate. He is now proposing a law where social media is banned for under 14s. The weird thing about this law is that you're not really meant to have a Facebook account up until the age of 13.
No,
anyway,
but of course, everyone does from like age.
Everyone
eight.
Does. Literally, it's like, are you 13 and above? You just click yes basically. Like, I didn't like.
Dude, that's how
you know
I got my
saying?
First Facebook account. Like, I mean, I'm pretty sure I was already 18.
No,
but you
you're
had
not
to pretend
young.
To be from a university.
That's what it is. No, when Facebook launched,
I lied about something to get Facebook.
I think it was probably no, because I joined Facebook when I was at university. I think maybe you
2006?
Joined earlier. I don't know. Maybe
a
you joined
five?
Earlier. Yeah, maybe
but didn't you have
but
to
anyways.
Be at a university? I don't know. Basically, I lied to get on social media. We all lied to get on social media, even when we were young. Zanga, all these things.
Yeah.
You just lied.
But I think now it's a different animal. Social media back then was, what are my friends up to?
Yeah.
And let me just poke them, basically. And then I'll go about my normal day. So and then when
innocent.
I log back, yeah. And then when I log back onto my computer again, like, you know, a couple hours later, I'll have a look maybe, or maybe like the next day.
Yeah.
Now, for under 14-year-olds, they are bombarded and assaulted with a level of visual stimulus and stimuli that is hitherto unknown, basically.
Yes.
And there's been so much data, especially around young girls, how it has increased anxiety, depression rates. And whenever people say, whenever you say this, people are just will say back to you, well, it's just because people are more comfortable speaking about it. That's actually probably not the case, because self-harm rates have gone up too. So this is not just like verbally, oh, I'm feeling this way. No, this is people actually physically doing self-harm, which is borne out, which demonstrates to me that the data is pretty conclusive that this is now an increase, not just a verbal...
We're talking about it more.
We're talking about it more. And why is that the case with young women? I'll speak out of turn, because obviously I'm not a young woman. I'll let you give your analysis after, because I know you know this stuff probably a lot more than me. But just quickly, from what I've read, essentially it's because the phenomenon of way girls use these apps is basically putting stuff out there and saying, like, do you like me? A, do you like me? Please like me. Like, can somebody just like me, basically? Two, bombarded with images of perfection that you cannot attain to. Body shapes, you know, all kinds of stuff. Do you think your mind could have handled this at that young age? I'm not talking about Facebook. We're talking about TikTok, IG. Like, what impact do you think it is having on young girls then, beyond what I've just said?
So a statistic I read on the BBC was that 1 in 6 UK teens face cyberbullying. So often, you know, that message, that post to put yourself out there will then expose you to people who be like, no, you don't look good. In fact, you look ugly and you look fat and you look this. And, you know, I remember when I was young, my older siblings used to like bully me by calling me fat, fat Abba. And that was like the most terrifying and tragic thing that could have happened to me. And that was just like verbal taunting. Imagine if like a million people on the internet were saying that to you every day. Mm-hmm. Like,
it would be a real
struggle.
Chat.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, the school that I used to go to, like, there was, like, a lot of, like, there was, like, a Snapchat bullying case that, like, got really, really bad. Like, people were, like, suspended, expelled. I don't even know. So, like, this stuff is real. I think the other thing that we don't really talk about when it comes to children on the internet is, like, sexual harassment and abuse, right? So, here in the UK, cyber flashing is... a thing, it's a crime, and the first person to be convicted of cyber flashing has gone to jail. This was literally this month in March. Now, when I started reading the article about cyber flashing, I'm not gonna lie, I was triggered, because I was reminded of how I used to go on like teenagechatroom.com like in 1999 with my other friends, where, you know, we're like 11 or 12 or whatever, and go on these websites and pretend to be 14 or 15 or 16. And then guys just slide in and send dick pics. Like, the first erect penises I saw were on the internet, because I was in a teenage chat room just trying to make friends. And people were what is now known as cyber flashing me. So when I was reading that article, I was like, oh, shit. Yeah, that is a crime. I was assaulted. But I didn't know because it was the wild, wild west of early internet. So I... never thought I'd say I agree with Rob DeSantis. This is so weird. What's happening? But I do agree. Like, we need to do something. I mean, I've said it on the podcast before. In the future, there's going to be health warnings when you open up these apps.
Yeah, I agree.
Increased exposure will cause God knows what.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, how do you do age verification? That's the problem. You're going to have to do some sort of upload your
ID. What do you
ID
mean that's the
Facebook?
Problem? Like, how do you open a bank account with a fintech app?
No, that's what I'm saying. But are you willing to give Facebook that level of data about you in that sense? Like, are you willing to give
people out there giving access to their entire photo library that has photographs of your driving license, photographs of your passport? Most people in the world have a photograph of their ID on their phone and they've already given access to all photos. Like, Facebook can, like, honestly clone you and your family and your loved ones. So I don't think that's the barrier. The barrier is the social media companies, you know, need to keep growing. You know, that's why they still have fake accounts. That's why they still have spam bots. Like, they need those numbers. They need them there. And in the same way, they need kids.
Yeah.
What happened to cigarettes? When cigarettes started getting more and more constrained in their availability in, you know, more developing countries, you can't advertise here, you can't advertise there, you can't have these flavors. What did the tobacco companies do? They went to countries where the regulations weren't there. You can buy a single cigarette in Nigeria and the Philippines. You can buy a single cigarette, which hasn't been illegal here for many, many years. Anybody checking the IDs of people buying a single cigarette? These people are kids. So, you know, these tech companies, they'll find a way to adapt so that they can still keep growing.
It's amazing though how vaping kind of snuck in the back door and has basically created a new cohort of like nicotine addicted people. It's actually insane, because
people smoking now with vapes.
When vaping launched, it was like, oh, this is a great way it's for healthier. Smokers to have a healthier alternative. Bro, they induced more demand from non-smokers. I know so many vapors who were not cigarette smokers, and it's like, bro,
because
like,
they come in flavors like blueberry, passion fruit, crush, pineapple, joy. Like, there were no cigarettes that tasted like juicy fruit and like, you know, Skittles. That wasn't a thing. Like, you had to be smoking like that cowboy on the friggin' horse, Marlboro Red, like smoking a log. That's what smoking
tasted
like.
Listen, I'm sorry.
But now kids are out there like smoking candy.
You're going to see some 45-year-old Gen Z people out here standing like Stephen Hawking with a voice to score. I'm sorry, man. I ain't trying to be discriminatory against people who have got legitimate illnesses. But listen, if you self-induce that on yourself because you thought it was cool to vape and you're out here with a, you know, a throat box that can't work when you're in your 40s, don't come at us, man. That's what I'm saying.
I'm sorry, but vapors are annoying because they vape in places that people never would have smoked. Can we just talk about this? Like, you've opened me up to a proper auntie rant now. I was in the bathroom in Dalston, this is East London, like a few nights ago. And you know how sometimes like the area to wait for the bathroom is enclosed. Mm-hmm. So you kind of open the door and you're like, oh, there's another weird little hallway here, but I've got to wait for one of the toilets to be free. So I'm standing in there, like the place cannot be like bigger than two phone booths with a woman in front of me waiting to go in. Guess who starts vaping? Obviously, this woman starts vaping in there. I was like, sorry, do you mind not vaping? And she's like, oh God, sorry. Like, I didn't even notice I was doing it. And I was just like, what? I've seen people vaping on the tube, vaping on the bus, because it's like more innocuous or whatever, like harder to perceive. People just do it anywhere. But yeah, those tobacco companies, I'm telling you, they're smart. They're smart.
Techish is sponsored by Intuit, a global technology platform that serves millions of customers worldwide with TurboTax, Credit Karma, QuickBooks, and MailChimp. They are now hiring for a variety of tech and non-tech roles across all products and regions. At Intuit, you'll be part of a team that emphasizes the importance of diverse voices to drive innovation and power and prosperity for all. Check out Intuit's career opportunities waiting for you. Visit intuit.com/pocket. That's intuit.com/pocket. Link in the show notes. On a side tangent, something that I thought was really, really fascinating, I saw a graph essentially looking at the number of employees it takes in the S&P 500 to generate $1 million in revenue. So
one
in
million.
1990, yeah, so for every $1 million of revenue, how many employees do you need? So back in the 90s, early 90s, you needed at least 8 employees to generate $1 million per S&P 500 company. Now, that number is as little as, it's basically one, basically. So To generate a million dollars as an S&P 500 company, you just need basically one employee.
And that number
is basically collapsing. Eventually, we will see a one person or a two person, you know, $100 million, $1 billion unicorn company. And it is kind of amazing though. The cost of creating things is getting cheaper and cheaper. For some reason, prices keep going up and up. Like that's the contrary truth. It's like there's massive deflationary cycle in tech where like you can build all this kind of stuff for an incredibly amount of cheap. But prices haven't necessarily got that much cheaper, have they? I don't know. What's your thoughts on a one person unicorn? Is it a healthy thing for society that could be the case, that you can create so much value without having to disseminate that amongst the population? Because you know, when Instagram sold for $1 billion, there was about 10 people. When Kodak was a $1 billion company, it probably was like 10,000 employees. So, like, what's the implications?
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
I think one of the hallmarks of capitalism, and it's not like something I'm making up, this is like a real quote, but it's like, you know, a lot of excess with a lot of suffering, right? And a lot of like deprivation. And software has enabled the acceleration of that gap in many, many ways, right? Because people who are already wealthy can now accrue wealth at a much faster rate, and people who aren't wealthy and can't access that, you know, remain at whatever level of capital they have. So it terrifies me a little bit, but at the same time, there's another side of that coin, right? It could be that that person is someone from a historically excluded community and uses the capital that they've gained as a lean team, as a small entrepreneur, to, you know, reinvest into those communities. If I look at the arts sector at the moment, which I'm, you know, a big supporter of, I'm on the board of Art Fund. We see like a decline in state funding for arts programs. So we see like theater struggling to stay open, galleries struggling to stay open, artists, especially from historically excluded communities, struggling to access resources, time, spaces to make work. And in the gap that's been left by state funding, it's actually like private funding that's stepping in, philanthropy funds. And, you know, one of the philanthropy funds I was interacting with recently was the Ford Foundation. Now, the Ford Foundation is literally just the money left behind by Henry Ford and his son when they died. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now it is led by a man, Darren Walker, an incredible person who also happens to be Black and also happens to be queer. So sitting in this position of privilege, he's doing everything he can to redistribute power and like create amazing programs to like, I don't know, have my diverse curators. So yes, I'm afraid in some ways, but at the same time, the optimist in me is like that person that becomes that single unicorn or whatever could be Black, brown, queer, disabled, Muslim, whatever, and end up using the wealth they've created to actually shape society in a really positive way. They could also just end up being Elon Musk. So, you know, it's a coin toss.
I think, just to push back on that, I just think basically we're holding our hopes that a person who hits that unicorn basically is a good person. And there's no guarantee that basically that could be the case, basically. And I think, you know, historically in tech, at least, there was always that famous story of like, you know, the Microsoft secretary who basically became a millionaire because she was secretary of Microsoft. She got shares. And that is kind of going away because like, one, I was listening to the All In podcast and Jason Calacanis said that a lot of the early stage teams that he's seeing, you know, they're only giving equity to maybe like the top three people. And then the rest of them are all kind of outsourced contractors in Portugal, you know, in the Philippines, et cetera, using AI, using chatbots, using, you know, ChatGPT, using GitHub Copilot. And that essentially now you are less likely to have that famous story of like, you know, the average person who's the graffiti artist at Facebook and he makes, you know, David Cho made $700 million. Like, I don't know if it's a good thing that less and less people are getting the pipe. But where it is an opportunity is for people like you, people like me, people who are listening to the show, you can do so much more now with so much less.
Yeah.
Don't get it twisted. So it might not be you're going to build a unicorn, but could you build a company making like $300,000, $400,000 a year in revenue, just let alone you? Absolutely, you can. That is not implausible anymore. That is actually like relatively plausible if you are dedicated and driven. Like, I'm not saying it's easy and it probably won't happen, but it can happen in a way that historically you couldn't do that, basically, right? To have a business doing that kind of revenue in the past, you needed like at least like 100 grand to like set up a shop, set up a restaurant, shut up. You know what I mean? It costs money to do those things. Now you build a little SaaS tool using no code. Do you know what I mean? So it's scary. There's opportunity afoot, but a lot of people are going to be cut out of that opportunity. And that's the contradiction that I see, basically. But to our supporters and to people that I know, I'm telling them, yo, take advantage of the shit. This is a gold mine. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. And I actually am irked that I'm not really taking advantage of the kind of AI revolution by building AI products. I'm kind of busy and preoccupied. I see a lot of builders out there building like just wrappers around ChatGPT, and they're making a lot of fucking money. They're making dough. Like, I'm like, okay, like, good for you. Like,
Peter Levels has been playing around with like a lot of different things, hasn't he? But also like, so two things I want to say on this. The first thing is like, a lot of people are going to be left behind in the generative AI awareness. And I always encourage people, like, if you haven't played with ChatGPT, do it sooner rather than later. If you haven't been on DALL-E, do it sooner rather than later. Because I think tech has this way of like making, you know, ordinary people feel like everything's really complicated and requires a lot of like intelligence and grit. And the reality is like, if you're already interacting with like online games or software for work, it's not that much of a stretch to set up a Twitch account and start generating images, or set up an OpenAI account and start, you know, playing around with the things that it can do. So that's the first thing I was going to say.
I want to quickly pivot to Candace Owens quickly, briefly. Because Candace Owens has just been fired. Yeah, your role model. Candace Owens has just been fired at the time of recording from the Daily Wire. And, you know, we don't know the reason why, but essentially it's because she's been very outspoken against against Israel and the war they've conducted basically in Gaza.
Oh, really? Now, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, she's actually been quite vocally
I kind of just don't pay attention to anything. I wouldn't say,
yeah, listen, I commend you. Don't get twisted. But at the moment, she's kind of going on a tour on a lot of black outlets to kind of like rehabilitate her image, because I think she realizes that.
Well, because her BLM documentary flops.
Well, I think the BLM documentary probably made the Daily Wire a lot of money. But I think she's now being fired, so she's probably looking for a new audience, or at least trying to kind of rehabilitate her image amongst the black community, because she basically made her fortune basically being the black person who could say the racist things that white people can't say. Now, yeah. She then tried to flip it around.
The black face of white supremacy is what I
essentially,
like to call
right?
Her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But she then tried to open up, because Dogger just did, as much as she's been vocally supportive of kind of the Palestinians in a situation, she's also said quite a few things that are anti-Semitic, I would say. And she's crossed that line.
I was going to say, she was homies with Kanye at one point when he was in his anti-Semitism era.
She was defending him, you know, when he was saying, you know, DEFCON, whatever on the Jews. She was like, no, he's misunderstood. All bullshit, basically, right? So from what I can see is she got too big for her boots and thought she could use foolish rhetoric that she used against the black community on other communities, and she lost her job, basically. She thought, oh, like, she basically didn't realize what she was paid to do. You're paid to be the mouthpiece of white supremacy. Do not try and, you know what I'm saying, like,
they
flip
put her
it on
in a
other
place.
Communities. Yeah, don't try and flip it on other communities, because those communities are going to protect themselves and say, nah, we're not, you're fired. Do you know what I mean? She's probably sitting there thinking, but hold on. I've said all this fuck shit about black people. I've said all this thing about, you know, there's no racism, it's all your fault, you know, it's because your daddy ain't there, it's, you know, blah, all this bullshit. And you try to flip it on another community, and they're like, well, actually, we pay your checks, you're gone. And I mean that in the sense that obviously there's Ben Shapiro is Jewish, and obviously he probably is very staunchly advocates for Israel. And he was like, nah, we ain't pay you for that. We ain't pay you for all this. You gotta go. So yeah, I don't know. What's your thoughts on, I know you don't follow her particularly, but based
on
what
I'm fascinated
said,
by her. I'd be lying if I said I wasn't fascinated by her. And I think it will be interesting, you know, for future generations of humans to look back on this time and analyze her and what she represents, and also like what she means in a way, because it is interesting to have someone from like a historically marginalized community, you know, use their agency to be a mouthpiece for an oppressor of their community, you know, for their own individual wealth accumulation and their own individual like gain and like status. And you know, I don't know her well enough, but she's a fascinating person, you know, for that alone. I just find it really interesting. I kind of put her in the bucket of people I'm really fascinated by, like Stalin, Hitler, Candace Owens, like, you know, like I remember there was a time where like during high school when I was like studying Stalin and Hitler for like you know, history, and my friend came into my room and my desk was like covered in books like about the Third Reich, like concentration camps, and my friend was like, should I be worried about you, like, are you, like do we need to do an intervention? And I was like, I swear it's just research. I think I had like Mein Kampf on the desk, so I was like, I swear it's just research, like I'm genuinely just interested. And I kind of put Candace Owens in that bucket. But I do think that what is interesting is that she has been checked, hasn't she? She's been checked. Mm. Like, she's like, okay, oh, you know, you ain't that cute, girl. You ain't that cute. And it's interesting that, you know, even she is still going to face her own misogynoir. She's still, even in those circles, not protected from, you know, her own, her own identity and how that limits her. And I'm thinking about that in contrast with people like Joe Rogan, who've repeatedly used the N-word and are still thriving and living their best lives as content creators and as personas. But yeah, we'll see what happens. I mean, I don't know much about Ben Shapiro either, but in the grand scheme of things, is it a big L to like not be collaborating with him anymore? I mean, I guess if you're in that world, then it is. But
well, I think
maybe
I think
this is a wake-up call.
She's basically made her fortune. She's built her audience off the backs of kind of basically white supremacy talking points, basically.
Yeah.
So now she'll be fine. She's basically got her audience. She's got her community. She's got her millions. But it's just,
she can go on Truth Social.
Truth Social, baby. Actually, do you want to do a quick Q1 review? How has your Q1 been, basically, on a business level?
Basically, Founders Corner.
Because I'm becoming that nerd who basically does everything by quarters, isn't it? So I would love to know, like, wins, losses, lessons, this first 3 months, like, what was kind of
thinking? There's a distortion effect in the media where when something is reported on a lot, it feels very real, but that might not be backed up by the evidence that you're actually getting. And
right,
that's happening with AI hype right now, generative AI. A lot of people in the industry are actually like kind of annoyed by the hype machine that's being created by the press. They always do this. It's VR one day, then it's AI. And in a similar way, I actually feel that the media have done that with the backlash to DEI. Like, I think it's just become good clickbait and it's just become good fodder. And I feel that at the beginning of this year, I believed that that was going to limit my business. And I believed that that was going to hold us back. But we've had a better Q1 this year than we had last year. And I think that is driven by the fact that the sector that we focus on, tech, is, you know, coming out of a period of like aggressive cost cutting, and people are just like, do you know what? At the end of the day, like, we still have a team, and this team want training, or they need training, and we're going to invest in training, or we're going to invest in consulting because, you know, we want to improve our representation. So we've had a really strong Q1. It's been a struggle at times though, because my team is smaller than it was last year. You know, I just assumed it was going to be another, you know, bare year. So I was like, let me make some cuts, like, let me run lean. So there are times where to meet that demand, it was working long nights, working through the weekends. But I'm coming to the end of Q1, like, incredibly proud of what we've been able to achieve, and actually, like, a lot more optimistic about diversity, equity, and inclusion in tech and the corporate space in general than I was at the beginning of the year, based on like headlines I was reading and tweets I was reading. But yeah, how about you?
Yeah, something very similar. I think the moral of the story is don't pay attention to the headlines, man. Look at the actual data. Look at what's actually happening on the ground. Yeah. Similar, we had to do layoffs, unfortunately, just because we thought, like, okay, business is not going to be what it once was. Last year was kind of brutal. Obviously, you had the combination of just a tech session in combination with the backlash to kind of DEI or diversity and inclusion, et cetera, et cetera. So we were like, oh boy, maybe this is going to be another rough year. But actually, things have picked up. Things are doing well.
Yeah.
And we made a few tweaks to the business as well. So we started doing a lot more like reoccurring revenue.
Yeah.
We pivoted to like media sales. So we make a lot more money now on newsletter sponsors, on social media sponsors. And before, we were very much heavy, just like only recruitment. So it's been a juggling. And we're launching a paid community like coming up this quarter. So that will launch. So basically, we've managed to make the team smaller, unfortunately, but managed to increase revenue and work on new products. And obviously, hopefully, we can re-expand the team once things get back to bed. We probably are a bit short staffed, so maybe we'll be hiring in the future.
I feel you.
So,
I feel you on
yeah,
that.
So it's yeah, listen, Q1's been good. So hopefully, you know, let's see.
Let's hope it stays good, because I want to get at least what I've got in Q1 every quarter of the year. Then I'll be happy with my end of year revenue. You know what I'm saying? I'll be like, then I can start thinking bigger about team size and stuff like that. I will say, on that idea of business improvements, sometimes bad periods, I'm now realizing over the long arc of time, are good for you as a business owner. Because I feel like going through a challenging period made me so much more disciplined. And we've spoken about it on the podcast before, about our subscriptions and all that kind of stuff. But it made me so much more disciplined on my processes. Like, I really analyzed that whole sales funnel in my business. And I also mentioned to you, but I don't think I mentioned to the listeners, that I've been getting coaching from Sophia Amoroso as well. And that's been so helpful, having an expert just tear everything apart. Like, what about this? What about that? So one of the, you know, big pieces of advice that she gave me early on was like, you know, you need to widen the top of your funnel. Like, every point where you exist online should drive people towards your business, like how to get in touch with you, how to get your service. And even though it's so obvious to say that, had I actually done that on every social media account, checked what people were linking to, you know, in every sign up flow for my newsletter, checking what automated content was going their way. And, you know, if you're a business owner and you're using Calendly, like, have you been looking at things like Calendly workflows? I spent a whole day on Calendly realizing that I was underutilizing the automations that are already available within the premium account that I pay for, which is only about $100 a year. It's really not that much. So, if anyone is in a bit of a rut with their business and struggling to see the upside and struggling to see the positive, I will tell you, as someone that's coming out of that, that it's such a good time to look at your processes and look for those opportunities to tighten things up, improve things, and, you know, ultimately, like, make that customer experience better and more in line with your sales targets, with your goals.
Yeah. It's interesting, because when we spoke, you were kind of like, bruh, you need to get more hands-on with your sales. And that's basically what I've done in this pretty much.
Yes, I told you that. I think you listen to me.
I listen to you. Yeah, I do listen sometimes, you know what I'm saying? But like, it's one of those things where I'd got into that zone where, because I had a sizable-ish team, I started to become that kind of, not aloof, but the person who's kind of looking at things from a top level and, you know, getting people reporting into me. And then basically, you know, it's not peacetime. Now it's wartime CEO. Mm. So I was like, as a wartime CEO, I'm getting on these sales calls and I'm closing these things. And I was closing deals because, to be honest, as the person who's built my products, nobody knows them better than me, basically.
Exactly.
So getting your hands dirty is just necessary. And I enjoy it.
People enjoy are more it. Inclined to buy from the CEO as well. Like, I was having this conversation with Sophia because she was like, I sell for my business. Yeah. Like, yeah, I'm on the cover of magazines, but I'm going to do it. Because people like that. They're like, I'm talking to the CEO. And if they're speaking to competitors and you're the one whose hat is in the ring coming through as a CEO, that's already an advantage to you over the other competitors who are sending the counter.
It's also skin in the game. Like, you can hire a salesperson and put them on commission, but like, they're still not going to be as incentivized as you, the owner, to be like, no, we need to close this deal. Like, follow up immediately. And let's, you know, what can we do extra? Can we do a webinar? Can we do training? Can we do it? Like, all kinds of stuff. So yeah, lots of lessons learned really from me in this quarter and where the improvement has come from.
Oh, I was going to just plug my event.
Yeah, go for it.
I'm doing a free webinar. It's called How to Be More Inclusive at Work in Your Interactions with Your Team, Clients, Job Candidates. It's free. It's a chance for you and your team to get some Hustle Crew training. So come through. It's on the 16th of April, 8 a.m. East Coast time, 1 p.m. UK time. Head to tinyurl.com/HustleCrewFree. So HustleCrewFree. So head to that URL, share the link with your team, and I will see you there on the 16th of April.
We'll put that in the show notes. All right, everyone. That's been this week's Techish. Thank you for listening. Hit us up at Techish Pod. Subscribe, review, share with a friend, and we love you lots. We'll catch you next week.
See you soon. Peace. Bye.
Bye.